News on the Mark.
You are listening to Screenfish Radio. I'm your host, Steve Norton. This week on the show, Kevin McLenathan stops by and we talk about The Post, Steven Spielberg's latest drama, talking about The Washington Post as it reveals the news on the Watergate scandal in the 1970s. We also talk about our fave movie moments of 2017. Plus, later on in sports, the Yankees have won the World Series yet again. Can that juggernaut be stopped? Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Welcome to Screenfish Radio. We are so excited this week to talk about Steven Spielberg's The Post, which stars Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep. And it's wonderful to have returning guest Kevin McLenathan from Seeing and Believing back. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thanks, Steve. It's good to finally be back after, a year between episodes? it's good to return finally at last.
Well, you know, Kevin, it works so well because with a year between podcasts, the last time we were on was the first one of 2017, and this is the first episode of 2018. That means it's top pick episode of the last year. So you got suckered in again.
You know what? I'm totally on board with that. I'm a big fan of the, you know, best X of the previous year. You know, best movie moments, best movies. I like ranking things, I guess. What can I say?
Well, I'm glad because we are at it again with our top movie moments of the year. And when I say movie moments, I mean it may not be the best picture of the year, but a moment in a film that just struck you, was a favorite for yours, you know, something like that, whether it was some sort of impact, and it goes across the board. So if you're okay with it, we can do our top threes.
Yeah, sure. Let's jump in.
Sure, sounds good. Now, so Kevin, what is your number three movie moment for 2017?
Well, my number three is from a movie that I didn't actually get a chance to see when it first had its theatrical release. I had to catch up with it on when it was released to streaming and on demand because it's a little foreign film from the Dardenne brothers called The Unknown Girl. The Dardennes are Belgian, and I'm a huge fan of theirs just in general, and I was excited to see that they had a movie coming out in 2017. And The Unknown Girl, for anyone who hasn't seen it, it centers around this young doctor at a free clinic in the inner city who becomes party to the murder of a stranger, a young girl, the unknown girl of the title. The police are unable to identify this girl, and so the doctor takes it upon herself to find out the identity of the murdered girl so that she can inform the girl's family, wherever they might be. So it's a, you know, pretty simple premise, and it's a relatively straightforward movie. I like to say that the Dardennes kind of make grace procedurals in the same way that other directors make police procedurals or crime procedurals. Everything in this movie is, you know, very methodical. Matter of fact, we follow the doctor from place to place as she tracks down the identity of this girl. But that matter of factness makes the moments of grace and human connection all the more poignant and profound when they do surface. So my number three movie moment, coming to that at last, comes towards the end of this film after the doctor has succeeded in locating this girl's family. And the scene is between the doctor and one of the girl's relatives. And there's a moment during their conversation where the family member asks for a hug and they embrace. And that small moment, just because of in the context of the film and given what we've come to know about the doctor and everything she's gone through to you know, to find this, the information to find this woman, that just, it's just such a quiet moment, but it's one of the most emotional moments of 2017. And it, you know, it almost brings your heart up into your throat to watch such a simple moment of human connection, just how a simple gesture like that can mean so much and communicate so much care and kindness in it. So I highly recommend to anyone who hasn't had a chance to see it yet, The Unknown Girl is one of my favorite films of last year. So,
yeah, I have not seen that. I am familiar with the Dardennes a little bit, very, very little, but I haven't seen that one. I'll be sure to take a look for it. It sounds like it's a great film. My number three is a little different. And I know, Kevin, historically, you're a huge fan of superhero films. almost overwhelmingly so. So I...
Yeah, you know, it is your show, so you can create your own truth.
That goes well for the post later on, actually. But
we're tying it in already.
That's right. It's symmetry. There is a very quiet moment, and I have to admit, there are two quiet moments. I have to go back to Logan. Logan, of course, is the culmination, if you will, of Hugh Jackman's career as Wolverine. I say his career as Wolverine because it's certainly not the culmination of Hugh Jackman's career. But and maybe I'm showing my age, but I feel like I've sort of grown up with Hugh Jackman in this role. You know, having watched, you know, films of his film, X-Men films that were good and X-Men films that were unwatchable, depending on how you viewed the franchise. Logan was something completely different and quite, in some ways, quite a risk for Fox. And there's a moment that most people I was talking to didn't catch that really sort of struck me. And I admit it's in some ways it's a little silly to say this, but he's trying to get this young girl to the quote unquote promised land for New Mutants. And they stop at a gas station. And she sits on this machine and she's trying to make it work. She can't make it work. She bares her claws and she goes to break it. And he stops her and he gives her a quarter. And this I admit, this is me showing my age. He looks at her and he says, "Last ride. You're welcome." And, you know, it's this little thing. And most people I talk to, they're like, "Yeah, so." But for me, it was like, it was such a lovely nod to the fans as sort of a thank you for supporting him over the 17 or 18 years he's been playing this character. You know, it was a very simple moment. If I could, I might even, there was another moment in the film that I would consider even swapping it. It was a family dinner. But it was just between him and Patrick Stewart and the girl, that was, again, it was sort of this pure moment of innocence. But that moment where he almost sort of thanks the people for supporting him in this, really, you know, as a superhero character, I thought, you know, I was digging that. It was very quiet. It was very subtle. But it was there, and I appreciated that. So I had to put it in. Number three.
Yeah, I have to confess, I was pretty strongly mixed on Logan as a whole. There are parts of it that I liked quite a bit. I came away from it not liking it as much as I would have hoped. But the things that I did like about Logan are exactly the sorts of moments that you just talked about. The quieter moments, the moments that are less about superhero action and sort of delivering the Wolverine goods and more about just, you know, these quiet little character touches where we almost forget that we're watching a superhero movie.
Yeah.
We're watching more of a road movie or a movie where this character, Wolverine, kind of comes to terms with this, you know, the long years that we as an audience have spent with him. So I think those are the moments that you talked about are the moments that show Logan at its very, very best. Those were some great moments right there.
Yeah. Well, what have you got for number two?
Well, you know, I talked about emotional power with my pick for my number three, and I'm going to continue that theme with my number two. It's from Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water, and I'll refer to it only as the "You'll Never Know How Much I Love You" scene. And the reason I'm hesitant to talk about it in more detail than that is because one reason why it's so emotionally powerful to me is that it arrives at a moment and delivers a moment that, you know, in the context of the rest of the film, you're not expecting in the slightest. So one of the characters comes to a moment of decision, and in that moment, the film takes a shift into this very stylized territory, and there's kind of the song and dance number, and we don't expect this character to be engaging in that kind of a fantasy. We don't expect them to be able to see them do that. And that in itself speaks to the great depth of emotion this character is feeling in this moment of crisis. And I remember just sitting in the theater watching it, and number one, being overwhelmed by just how utterly beautiful it was filmed. It's just a very lushly filmed and framed and edited sequence, but also because of what came before, Del Toro is using the language of cinema to its fullest. It's taking this golden age Hollywood kind of fantasia of song and dance and putting it to a moment in the film where it's recontextualized in a way that is just utterly breathtakingly gorgeous. And I think that was the moment where I fell head over heels for the film. And, you know, I'm not entirely capable of being objective about it. I just love it so much. And for a film as odd in some places as The Shape of Water is, it definitely goes in some directions that are strange, maybe a little bit uncomfortable for some viewers, but a moment like that arrives and it makes it just, it's so ravishingly beautiful that it makes everything else just click into place. So I love it quite a bit.
I cannot deny The Shape of Water is a movie that just, it sweeps you away. And that is a beautiful moment. I wrestled with in my top three, including any number of scenes from that particular film. I didn't, but I think it was just because the film to me was such a sweeping narrative. There wasn't one thing that I could say, one moment, but yeah, you nailed it beautifully. It was, when you watch the trailer, I remember watching the trailer in September and October and thinking that is the most ridiculous premise for a film I've seen ever. Not ever. That's far too grand, but this woman in love with her fish man, and it's like, okay, but the film is just so lush, and it's like a dream that is so ground in reality is the wrong word, but it's just, it sweeps you in, and you can't help but fall in love with the film. I'm fully on board with that.
Yeah, it's Del Toro taking his love for these classic films of old Hollywood and kind of turning them on their heads in a way that still pays tribute to how much affection he has for them, while also just subtly making a statement about them and the kind of emotional power they can carry. I don't know. I'd probably better stop there just because I could talk about this for a really long time. It's my number two of the entire year of 2017. So obviously, like I said, I have a hard time not gushing about them.
That's fair. That's fair. My number two movie moment is one that, again, speaking of having a hard time gushing about a film, there was a film. In some ways, I feel like I'm going to another genre film, but it's so different than so many things we've seen. And that film is Baby Driver, and specifically the opening car chase, bank robbery / musical number to introduce the film. You know, the car chase scene is just incredible to see, and it brings you into the world very, very quickly. But when the next following scene is Baby going to get coffee, and the words of the song in his head are appearing on the wall, and he's just sort of this one shot, camera shot through the city as he moves. That's when you know that you're in for something special. And Baby Driver as a film, I think, was in many ways a very special thing. But that opening is quite lush and so unique from so many other genre films that you're going to see.
That absolutely. I'm really happy that this is on your list, because it's also on my list. It's my number one, if I can jump the gun a little bit. And you're absolutely right that this Edgar Wright, the director, is really just throwing down the gauntlet from the first moments of this film onward. He just it's an absolute barn burner of an opening, and it's almost like he's daring you not to be utterly enthralled by the you know, the amazing action choreography, the incredible editing where he syncs up the music on the soundtrack with the action on screen, so that, you know, it's almost as if what's happening with these cars and this car chase is choreographed like a ballet. It's almost like car ballet. And at the end of this 5 minute opening, I just had the hugest grin on my face and was totally on board for whatever Wright was going to do. And I think that's kind of what he's best at as a director, is taking his love of movies and making that infectious, so that you come to love the same things and love it with the same intensity that he does. And it's just a lot of fun. And I think, especially for the kind of year that 2017 was, something that's just infectious, great fun is not to be underestimated. I think that's just... It makes Baby Driver feel all the more special.
Yeah, it's true. It's such a unique film. And I'm glad that we haven't thrown the film entirely out because of the Kevin Spacey factor. Like, the film has survived that, and I think it deserves to. Like, it is a quality film. But, I mean, I understand all of the controversy about that. But it's a wonderful film right across the board.
It would be a shame if the film as a whole, which is such almost cinematic joy distilled, if it became lost to time because of the misdeeds of one of its stars.
Absolutely.
But yeah.
Yeah. Well, my number one moment is, I admit it's a little bit odd when you think about it, but there was one particular moment in 2017 film that was, to me, like a sucker punch to the gut that I can't deny was, I would say, impactful. To say favorite moment might be the incorrect term, but to me it had a real impact, and it comes from the Florida Project. And it's that final... Not, I mean, you can make the arguments about the final shot as Mooney runs to Disneyland, but it's actually the moment where she starts to, where everything sort of hits and her reality is sort of shaken, and she starts to cry. And it's not just this tiny sob; it's this gut wrenching emotional moment. And for so much of the film, I fell in love with these characters, and there's a brokenness, but there's also just a beauty about their care for one another. Willem Dafoe, for example, this moment where he just tells them that he loves them is beautiful. But there's this final moment with Mooney where she begins to cry as the DEA is taking her away from her mother. That, to me, favorite is the wrong word, but just an absolute sucker punch to the gut for me for my number one impactful movie moment.
Yeah, I vividly remember that moment you're talking about, and it's such a galvanizing moment, because this is a child actor, you know.
Yeah.
This is, you know, I think the actress herself is, I don't know, 5 or 6. She's very young.
Yeah.
And for her to be able to play that scene in a way that it almost seems like it's not acting, which something about the way Sean Baker directed her just hits at the emotional truth of that scene so hard it's almost unbearable. And I mean, that that's just one of the qualities that makes the Florida Project so memorable, is the Baker's ability and his actor's ability to really find the humanity in this situation, find the emotion in it, and just really play it with such truth that it's impossible not to be moved by it. It's really something special.
Yeah, it's so unique, and it's clearly dramatized, but it feels almost natural. Given the fact that most of the cast, Willem Dafoe aside, are relatively unknowns, it almost feels like you're watching reality unfold in the lives of these characters. And that moment, it just really impacted me. And like you said, almost unbearable to watch is a good way to describe it. So there we have it. We have our top threes. And actually, we also have a few others that from some of the Screenfish contributors that we would love to hear as well, their favorite movie moments. So let's hear what they have to say.
The single best, well, there's two of them now. I'll have to give number two was Luke Skywalker. This is number two. Luke Skywalker coming out of the bunker to confront Kylo Ren in Star Wars The Last Jedi. That was a moment some 34 years in the making, as we hadn't seen Luke do his thing since Return of the Jedi. So that was goosebump, happy chills moment. But nothing was bigger in 2017 than Diana Prince looking at that battlefield and looking at Steve Trevor and getting out there with her shield and her sword and handling her business in Wonder Woman. That was wonderful. That scene was everything. I can sit back and play that scene over and over with 7.1 surrounding in my room and just watch all of that, and dun, 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 dun. I could watch that scene over and over. That was the scene of the year for me, for sure.
Hey guys, happy new year. It's Julie Levac. Wow, when I think back on 2017, there are just so many amazing movies and amazing memories from different movies, but one that is standing out to me has to be going to see an advanced screening in Toronto of The Big Sick. Not only did I love the movie so much, but Kumail Nanjiani and Emily Gordon came out after the movie and spoke to us and did a question and answer period, and it was just such a fun night. The movie, if you haven't seen it, really brings you everything that you would want in a movie, with the exception of action, let's be honest. But there are so many different emotions. It's hilarious. It's heartfelt. And it is just fantastically executed. The screenplay, the cast, everything just brings it all together. I would highly recommend seeing it if you haven't already. And I think it was just a great night. And I keep thinking back on it. And I really, really enjoyed that, amongst so many other fantastic movie-related memories from 2017. I'm so excited for 2018, guys. Stay tuned. It's going to be fantastic. See you later.
My favorite movie moment of the year is the coffee run scene from Baby Driver, which was the most fun movie I saw this year. As the opening credits run, Baby, listening to music as always, moves and grooves to a coffee shop and back to where the crew is meeting. The music is timed perfectly to match various words and pictures along the way. It really takes multiple viewings to see it all. It's really a fun tracking shot.
Thank you all for contributing. Those are some great moments. You can see that they clearly were impactful for you, and I'm sure that you have your favorite moments as well as listeners. But tonight, Kevin, we're here to talk about The Post, which is Steven Spielberg's latest film, which actually, my understanding is it came together very, very quickly this year, but it follows the reveal in the 1970s of the lies told by the U.S. government regarding the Vietnam War, and covers the moments where the Washington Post finds the information and is wrestling with whether or not to release it and record it and send it out to the public, thereby opening the door for an enormous government scandal. Stars, as I said, Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep, which amazingly, I believe, is their first film together, which I can't believe. Before we get into the film, Kevin, we should just remind our listeners that if they haven't seen the post yet, that this podcast will be filled with spoilers, so we can talk about the film as we need to, just so you're aware. Kevin, what did you think of the post?
I liked it quite a bit, and you know, this is one of those films that almost seems calculated to be a crowd pleaser. Hollywood's holy trinity of Spielberg, Tom Hanks, and Meryl Streep all working on the same project. So it almost seems as if, like, okay, they're definitely fishing for you know, audience appreciation, for awards love with this film. But the great thing about Spielberg is that even while he's making these movies that seem like they should be kind of middle brow and mediocre and very forgettable, he is able to shoot these movies in a way that he finds the compelling core of them so naturally that they feel very, very vital, even when they seem like they should be very safe. And whatever the post is, it doesn't feel safe to me in the sense that, you know, Spielberg is really playing softball with this material. There's a lot of interesting, subtle work going on here, both at a thematic level and also just in the craft of the filmmaking itself, that I just think it is really good. And I think, I mean, the fact that it's so timely is another reason to like it. And that's maybe the least interesting thing about it is its quote unquote timeliness. That's kind of obvious and on the surface. But when you get past even that and start looking at some of the other things that Spielberg is doing with this film, I think it reveals a lot of depth to it that isn't maybe obvious at a first glance. So there's a lot to recommend this film. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
I have to confess that, I mean, I've obviously, Spielberg is known for, like you said, his crowd-pleasing films. And watching The Post, it's the first one in quite a while from Spielberg that I thought, wow, like, he didn't just show you something. He actually had a great script. And that's not a shot at any of his work, but sometimes when he does something well, he does it very well. Now, I understand he didn't write the script. That's not what I mean. But this film had a heat to it and an energy that I haven't seen in a lot of his work over the last few years. There was a fire. Everyone in this particular film seems to sort of attack their roles. One of the things that impressed me is any film that can take a scene where 10 people reading over copy editing or even the pouring over a room full of papers and making it fascinating to me is something unique in a script. Spielberg has a way of making you celebrate, but also challenging in this particular film. And I thought it was really, really well done.
I think that's the reason, the thing that I like the most about this film is the aspirational nature of it. You know, Spielberg isn't just telling kind of this based on true story. It's not, it is that obviously, but he's not just doing that to make some ideological points or to simply, you know, make a point. You know, he's also offering a portrait of a time where both reporting the news and reading the news and caring about the news, those were things that were highly prized. And what I like a lot about this film is it's aspirational in that it asks us to look at this time and not only enjoy the story being told, but also aspire to return maybe to that kind of mindset where the truth mattered more than simply whose side was right or wrong. The important thing was making sure that the truth was told and that it was told in a way that mattered, you know, that people paid attention to. And I think, you know, it's relevant to our times, but it's not relevant in our times just in making particular political point. It's relevant in that it says, remember what we once were, we can return to that. And I think that kind of subtext to everything that's going on in this film is what makes it feel really above average to me.
Yeah, I like the way that you said that, because the film in so many ways is a calling. The fact that it takes place in the 70s is not a gimmick. You know, it's a moment where a reminder that that our culture strived for greatness. And part of that greatness is rooted not in achievement, but in honesty and in truth. And I think that's a really interesting way to look at it in this particular film, because this film, my understanding is that Spielberg actually put a film on hold. And I think they opted the script in around February or March, and they shot it in like 6 weeks. It came together amazingly quickly. But there's an aspect of the film that's inviting you to not do more, but be more worthy of what we can be, which I thought was really interesting. You know, in light of that, talk about truth a little bit. There's a huge conversation going on within the film about the nature of truth. Clearly right now, the idea of truth has taken a hit. Do you think in a film like this suggests a means to restore it? Can truth be trusted? Because it's flipped all on its ear in this film.
I mean, I think when I think about that question, I think what this film is saying, and at least what I believe, is that the idea that truth makes certain demands of us, right? Mm. Like when we are confronted with the truth, that requires us to make adjustments, sometimes in our behavior, always in our thinking, and that those demands that truth makes of us are absolute. And insofar as we are aware of truth's demands, we're obligated morally to respond accordingly. In the post, there's this very subtle subplot running throughout with Tom Hanks's character. Hanks plays Ben Bradley. He's he leans left on the political spectrum. He really admires the Kennedy family a lot. He despises Richard Nixon. And one of the really interesting threads running through the film, his character arc, as it were, is that he comes to realize that he has to smash his idols too, that JFK had his own role to play in the Vietnam debacle, and that when he finds that truth in the Pentagon papers that he receives, it's incumbent upon him not to dismiss that just because that's his side. You know, he's on the side of the Democrats, so he doesn't want to believe anything bad about them. Over the course of the film, he comes to realize that truth is greater than any political party or any kind of set ideology, even greater than one's personal feelings for other people who one considers friends. And I think that's a really powerful thing this film is saying, that, you know, truth is an absolute moral good unto itself. And we have to come to a decision point where we decide, you know, what do we do when we know the truth? What do we do with that knowledge? Mm. And I think that this film is suggesting that what we do with the truth that we know is something that we'll be judged by, both by history and, you know, ultimately by God. Mm. The film doesn't put that fine of a religious point on it, but I think as a Christian viewer, you can easily make that extrapolation. And I think that that's something that feels the most vital about this film, not so much what it's saying about the, you know, the role of the media or the free press, but what it's saying about truth and our responsibility to the truth.
Yeah. Truth as a concept in this film is particularly powerful. And it's interesting because I think McNamara makes a comment and he says that it's easy for the papers to paint us as liars. Yet in the opening sequence, we actually see him lie. It says to his other military aides, there's been no progress. That means that things are getting worse. And then he immediately turns to the media and says, in every dimension, we're making progress. He sort of flips it around. And we see very quickly that in the context of the film, truth is something that is bigger. I like the fact that you talked about it as absolute and larger. It's something to aspire to. As opposed to flip around to suit your own needs. And in many ways, that feels very much like 2017. There's been a huge calling, and I'm not to get into all the political things, but certainly there has been a large-scale movement for the nature of let's know the truth and let's see things change. But one of the things I think is interesting, too, about this film is there's actually, from everyone outside the Post, because, of course, the people at the Post are the heroes in this film, there's a great fear of that truth. You know, whether it's the shareholders at the paper or the military, although the military, their viewpoint is not to keep things from the public, they have spun it in a way that says, you know, it's protection based. It's not about, you know, we have to have our secrets. It's not that sort of ill intent. They've sort of twisted it, though, to suit their own needs. And this calling to something larger than us is something wonderful within the film. I'm right on board with you on that.
And I appreciate, too, how Spielberg directs his actors in this film. It would have been easy for a film that's this pointed to paint the quote-unquote bad guys in a certain light. So McNamara, yes, as you observed, he's a character in this film, and he does lie. And the Pentagon Papers that we learn about over the course of the film make no bones about the fact that McNamara knew that the Vietnam War was a lost cause and yet sent many, many troops over there to die anyway. And it would be easy for McNamara to be portrayed by Spielberg as kind of this oily government man who, you know, is very self-serving. And while there's that dimension to his character, Spielberg is at pains to portray him as simply a guy who thought he was doing the right thing at the time, and in doing so, compromised himself morally at that. And Spielberg is saying, you know, people who do things like this, who lie or who bend the truth or who like to ignore the truth because it doesn't fit the way they see the world, you know, these aren't moral monsters.
Yeah.
Or at least they're not moral monsters in an extraordinary way. They're just people, just like you and me. And
yeah,
that's something that is... So that's something that the audience should be taking very seriously as they watch this film, I think.
Yeah, you wouldn't compare any of the military characters in this one to, say, Strickland in Shape of Water.
Definitely not.
No, because they're, you know, McNamara, they go to great efforts to show him he is a loving father. He's a caring husband. He actually, in those early scenes, behind the scenes, very much cares about what is happening in Vietnam. He's not some evil maniac who is, you know, seeking his own glory. So it is nice, in many ways, it is good to see his character as not just painted with one brushstroke, but his understanding of truth is one of fear. You know, what if the people knew these things? How would they view us? You know, at one point there's the line, nothing less than the integrity of the presidency is at stake, which, you know, I can't imagine that has any current political aspirations to it whatsoever. But certainly there's a lot of that. But it is an interesting conversation that the film does seem to hold objective truth in a higher standard than so many other films, you know, in recent years. But in light of that, though, Kevin, there's also the idea of justice within the film. And a film like this is clearly calling for a sense of justice, but what do you think it looks like that the film is calling us for?
That's a good question. I mean, if this film has a weakness, I think that it maybe portrays a bit too simplistic of a vision of what a victory for justice looks like. There's a shot towards the end of this film where Meryl Streep's character, she plays Catherine Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post, and she's walking down the steps, the courthouse steps, after being vindicated and winning a court case. And there's Spielberg stages it such that she walks by a huge crowd of women who all kind of look at her very, very worshipfully, very, yeah, very adoringly. And it's not that moment is unearned. I think one of the best things about this film actually is the way that Katharine Graham is portrayed in it as a woman trying to make her way through what is a very male dominated profession. That said, yeah, I think Spielberg maybe overreaches a little bit there, saying, you know, like, this is epochal and, you know, this is a victory for justice. And it almost feels like he's stepping a little bit too far, saying, you know, this victory that she won is a victory for all time. And I don't know that how on board I am with that. But I appreciate, though, that for this film, justice isn't just your side winning. You know, it's not one side beating the other side, the heroic liberal-leaning journalists being victorious against the evil Republican president. And that's not what it's all about at all. It's about a victory for truth coming out, being known and being shared so that the, you know, that lies will perish.
Yeah.
And that the purveyors of those lies will be brought to account for the falsehoods that they peddled. And that's very satisfying to see that in this film. But it also, Spielberg doesn't make it seem as if, well, they won and, you know, kind of they ride off into the sunset and everything's fine, because the way this film ends is with the very beginning of the Watergate scandal, the discovery of the break-in at the Watergate Hotel, suggesting that Spielberg's saying, you know, they won this great victory and justice was served, but there was still a lot of work to be done. And there still is a lot of work to be done. And I think that that's a very realistic, very measured view of justice, so that even when Spielberg does overreach in some of these moments, I think that on balance the film has a very inspiring and invigorating view of justice.
Mm. Surely you're not suggesting that Spielberg has moments in his films where he overreaches?
Some people say that he is a very subtle director. Some people say that he is, you know, maybe a little bit goes for the big gesture a little bit too much. Who's to say? But, you know, all joking aside, he's a great director.
Absolutely.
I sometimes wish he had pulled back a little bit at some moments.
Sure. World. Well, you know, in Meryl is wonderful in this film. And like I said before, I can't believe that she and Tom Hanks have never shared screen time together. But, you know, talking about the role of women in this particular film, one particular scene that actually in some ways steals the movie for me, if I were to look at my movie moment in this film, is actually where Hanks is talking to Sarah Paulson. There is a beautiful moment in the back, in their back room, I believe it is, and he's talking about his bravery and how much he has to lose for sharing this information and what he will do. And Sarah Paulson, who through much of the film is actually very quiet. She plays, quote unquote, the quiet wife in much of the film. And then she has this home run where she says to him, you've risked nothing. You'll get another job. But do you understand what Catherine has to risk? And she goes through this list. She goes, that's courage. And that particular scene I loved because it just sort of, it raised her character out of a supporting role into a way that sort of showed, I think, genuine equality and care, but also truth. I think in that particular scene, it sort of brings the role of women in the film beyond Meryl. You know, we know that Meryl is a powerful woman in the film. We know that she's fighting, she's wrestling with, you know, stepping out and taking the paper and the risk there. But there was a moment where Sarah Paulson sort of reveals that the voice of women genuinely matters in this film as well. It's not just about Meryl and Hanks. There are some really powerful supporting moments. And I agree with you as well that truth and justice are very closely tied in this particular film. And there's one moment where there is this decision to be made where it's where they say, if we don't hold them accountable, my God, who will? We can't hold them accountable if we don't have a newspaper. But there is still this urging to continue to fight for something greater than the easy road. And I think that justice in this particular film is that calling. Justice is pointing us to a sense of equality. Justice is pointing us to a sense of hope and truth. And I think that's a very powerful lesson, even when there are moments where Spielberg may reach a little far.
Yeah, that's a good observation, though. And I think one of the many things I appreciate about this film is how Spielberg is careful to emphasize that a commitment to justice can be costly. Mm. And that it's not just a matter of, well, just, you know, stick to your guns and your principles and everything will work out in the end because you have the truth on your side. Spielberg is also showing that there could have been very real world consequences. There could have been prison time.
Yeah.
The Washington Post could have failed. And yet they went forward with it anyway. And that's, I think, where the inspirational part of this inspirational true story comes in, is that even in the face of great cost, these characters, these people decided to go forward anyway. And you can't really have an honest accounting of the way the world works without both of those things. The idea that truth does matter, yes, but also sometimes it's going to be hard. And the Post pays tribute to both of those ideas, even if it does end up on, you know, with the good guys winning the day. The fact that it does take time to stress and emphasize those things, that makes it a cut above.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. By bringing in Watergate at the end, it becomes bigger than the good guys winning. We see that there is a much larger battle at stake than one moment, because there will be the next moment and the next moment. And that's why it's so important to have the concept of truth and justice be something we are accountable to rather than something we make accountable to us. Now, having said that, let's do Screen It or Skip It. Kevin, The Post, Screen It or Skip It?
Definitely screen it. I think that it seems too timely to ignore. And I think that anyone who goes to see it in the theater instead of waiting for a home release is doing themselves a favor by experiencing it that much earlier. Just it feels urgent, I guess. And it urgently demands to be seen. So that's my two cents anyway. What about you?
Oh, I absolutely agree. It's a screen it for me. You know, Spielberg, with my deep love and respect for him, there are films that I would very easily say, you know, skip it or check it out on Netflix. This is a film that I think makes use of the moment it has. And I will say this, it's also a great film to watch. It's not just that it has great things to say and has a calling. It's a highly, highly entertaining film as well. Absolutely. I have to ask this. I'm just thinking, since we've talked about top, would this be in your top 10 of the year? It falls somewhere on that list or maybe not?
Well, it's funny. Actually, last night was when Wade Bearden and I recorded our top 10 of 2017 episode. So that'll be going up soon. Sadly, The Post did not quite crack my top 10. I think it ended up at number 14 on my overall ranking of the year, so just barely missed the cutoff for the hallowed top 10, so to speak. But it's less because there's something seriously lacking with The Post, and more because I just think 2017 was an excellent year for films.
Oh, absolutely. And though I would caution you, having not heard your top 10, I really hope that the top 8 or 9 are not Marvel films. hopefully there's some space for other things on there. So I should just caution you about that before that episode is released.
Sure. Yeah, I do have to rein back my extreme fanboy appreciation for the MCU. You know, it wouldn't be right.
Kevin, thank you so much for being on. I absolutely love chatting with you, and I really appreciate you being on. How can our listeners connect with you?
Well, like I said, I am one of the co-hosts of Seeing and Believing. They can find our podcast the way they would find most other podcasts. You can just go into iTunes and download our episodes from there or stream them from the Christ in Pop Culture website, christinpopculture.com. I also tweet fairly frequently at McLengthyName on Twitter. So I talk about mostly movies, but occasionally books and whatever other art happens to catch my fancy at any given moment. So those are the two main places that they can find me. I do occasionally also write for Christ and Pop Culture, Christianity Today, and my own personal blog, kevinmclenathan.com. So that's a pretty comprehensive list, but hopefully one of those will pique your listeners' interest.
And, you know, one of the things I love that Christian Pop Culture does at this time is not just your top films of the list, which you guys are going to do on Seeing and Believing, as you said, but your top 25 things of the year, which I absolutely love. Because it ranges in everything from, which I think it's available online now, everything from Ghost Story to the Nintendo Switch.
the distracted boyfriend meme that made the rounds on Twitter, that is also an entry on the list. So it's pretty eclectic. I think anyone who goes on there will find at least one thing that they recognize and love. So that's the strength of the top 25 list over at Kapka.
Yeah, that's great. And of course, to our listeners here, you can find us in a lot of those same podcast places. You can find us on iTunes and SoundCloud and Stitcher, Podomatic. And of course, if you go to screenfish.net and go to this podcast page, you can download Fishing for More, which is small group questions that you can have with people that you see the film with, help to frame your conversation as well. So once again, Kevin, thank you so much for being on. It's just wonderful to have you back.
Yeah, well, it was great of you to ask me back on. It's been a fun time. Hopefully we can do it next year, too.
Absolutely. And to all of you at home, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish.